Hello, I'm Arvind Hickman, and welcome to the PR Weekly, your fix of PR industry news, analysis, and gossip. I'm joined by my colleague John Harrington, editor of PR Week UK. Today we are going to discuss pinkwashing during Pride, Naomi Osaka's very public withdrawal and how it has been handled, and MNC Saatchi Group's recovery. A bit later in the show, we have the founders of two agencies who launched during COVID to discuss how challenging it has been and what their futures look like. John, you were away last week. Did you go anywhere interesting?
I did. I went to Brighton. Just before we started recording, we were talking about the quality of beaches in Brighton and surfing opportunities because Lindsay, who's recording this, went to Cornwall the weekend just gone. And I think we're both very jealous of that to go surfing.
Absolutely.
So there wasn't any surfing, but there was a fair amount of drinking and merriment. So it was really good fun. But yes, I was listening to Cummings Come and Go as with the reception as I went down on the train to Brighton. And it was fascinating. I'm very glad actually that he said how, you know, it wasn't an error of comms in terms of the COVID problems. But other than that, I didn't get to hear all of it. But yeah, but it was interesting.
Well, I think he was blaming the chaos basically on really poor leadership, essentially, wasn't he? You know, the policies changing left, right, and centre, which is understandable. I mean, I know lots of people have different views about the Cummings revelations and whether he's a bit of a hypocrite, and obviously the answer is probably yes, but I did feel that quite a lot of what he said sounds quite plausible given the way things panned out. And even if you might argue that he's a hypocrite and argue that he did falter when he went on his drive to Barnecastle and what have you, and that he probably, you know, is part of creating the problem, I still think there are a lot of important lessons to be learnt that I'm just slightly concerned won't be learnt because of the tribal nature of politics and the world that we live in.
Yes, I agree. It was captivating, and it was absolutely damning, wasn't it? I mean, I wonder what would have happened if the recent elections happened a day or two after this session, if there would have been much change in how much the sort of public opinion of the government has changed. I mean, I saw that some opinion polls have swung a bit further against Tory party as a result of the hearing. I mean, I don't know how long that will last, frankly.
Yeah, it's a difficult one, isn't it? Because my sense is that a lot of people that decided to swing towards Johnson did so on a Brexit ticket, and they, you know, they kind of like dug their heels in. I don't know if it would have made a huge amount of difference, to be honest.
Probably not. And I wonder if, you know, a lot of the opinion polls, when people respond to them, maybe they say things that, you know, instinctively they're annoyed at the government because of what they did and they're angry. But when it comes down to it, you know, in months or years time, even if they are still feeling the same, they might, you know, the anger would have subsided and perhaps they have a different approach to things. It's difficult to tell, isn't it?
It is indeed. And another thing that's been captivating that happened over the weekend was Japanese tennis star Naomi Osaka, the number two ranked player in women's tennis, but many regard her as probably the best. She pulled out of the French Open, citing concerns about her mental health.
But Grand Slam tournament directors responded by threatening her with more substantial fines and future Grand Slam suspensions. In her statement, Osaka writes that she has suffered with long bouts of depression since 2018. Osaka says she is going to take some time away from the court, and she wants to talk with tour officials about ways to make things better for players, for press, and for fans as well.
Now, you know, it is mandatory for tennis stars to front up to press after each match, or they risk being fined. And initially, some commentators and pundits had criticised Osaka for the way she communicated her concerns about the media. She chose to publish it on social media rather than go through sort of official channels with tennis authorities. But the response from authorities has, you know, come across as lacking empathy. Today, John, as you might have noticed, we had a really well written comment piece from Calica's boss David Alexander about how Osaka's comms had improved with a second statement that she released announcing that she would withdraw and that she needed time out from tennis to look after her mental health concerns. What's your take in this, John, in terms of the Osaka thing and sort of how it played out?
Yeah, well, my first observation was when I was watching it unfold, how it immediately became a culture war battleground. You see this so often these days, don't you? So many of the responses were binary. Either it's Piers Morgan saying Osaka is behaving like a princess and she should be taking more responsibility, or it was others saying how brave she is to discuss mental health and criticising the uncaring kind of tennis establishment and the media. I mean, I don't think either of these views are entirely right. As David pointed out, she probably should have gone about her comms in a different way initially. Then again, it certainly seems true that the tennis authorities came across as entirely lacking in compassion. But as I say, what it shows to me is the level of discourse at the moment and when everything is filtered through social media bubbles. One key question really is, has it improved her reputation? I mean, maybe it's not the key question, but it's an interesting one. And on this point, I think it depends where you come from. I think if you live in the broadly sort of liberal kind of social media bubble that we do, which, you know, let's face it, we do, undoubtedly, yes, I think, you know, she's an extremely talented sports person, shining a light on a crucial area of mental health. But unfortunately, social media isn't the real world in many cases. And I imagine a lot of people will take Piers Morgan's line that it's hard to have too much sympathy for a multimillionaire who appears healthy during the time of pandemic. And I actually think there are very few celebrity-led campaigns these days that seem to unite both sides of the culture war. I think the nearest probably is Marcus Rashford's campaign on school meals.
Yeah, I think part of the problem with this one, it's a very complex issue. And I think part of the problem is when you do something that may rightly or wrongly be perceived as attacking the media or attacking the press, as this case was, even though I don't believe that was her intentions, you are going to get, you know, the red tops and certain sections within the media who will then push back. And that's clearly what's happened here. I think it raises quite a number of really interesting issues. And you know, Jonathan Liu at The Guardian wrote an excellent piece about sports press conferences and how they kind of need an overhaul, and how, you know, journalists are not generally the good guys. And I kind of agree with that. You know, I used to be a football reporter and sat through many of these press conferences where they'd ask the most inane, pointless, obvious questions. And then sometimes I'd get a little bit weird and creepy when they were trying to find out things about people's personal lives and that sort of stuff. So I can certainly understand the athlete's point of view, but I can also kind of understand why it is important they do engage with the media. I guess one of the interesting things here is, you know, that whole dynamic is shifting. It used to be perhaps where the media had a lot more importance or power as a conduit for fans, and, you know, to connect sort of fans with athletes in terms of what they were saying. But now you're seeing a lot of athletes and celebrities who are using social media to communicate directly, which is what Osaka did in this occasion. And she probably didn't quite go about it the right way around, because she didn't, you know, advise authorities ahead of time. So that's another interesting dynamic, isn't it? How we're seeing athletes now who are trying to sidestep the media and sort of create their own narrative and speak when they want to speak.
Yeah, I mean, and this can be a hugely effective way. A lot of the time, you know, it really offers a way for athletes and other celebrities as well to connect with fans directly, to get their right tone of voice, to be in control of what they do, and to come across as being authentic. But it can be risky. I mean, I don't know if Osaka discussed what she was doing first with her PR team, but as she acknowledged herself, the first statement probably wasn't the right way to go about it. So, I mean, there are upsides and downsides to this, just as there are upsides and downsides to engaging with the media. I mean, I also think that this whole episode shows the difficulties around comms and mental health. I mean, it's a very difficult area to discuss. I've seen lots of posts saying you wouldn't expect her to have an interview if she'd just broken her arm or whatever. I mean, the trouble is broken arms are much easier to diagnose and for people to understand. I'm no expert on, but as far as I can tell, mental health comes in many forms and it has many different symptoms. Some of them we can't tell, and we will never be able to tell as an outside observer. So, from my point of view, either we say if someone has mental health problems, as opposed to, let's say, being upset at a particular time after losing a match, then we should believe them, and then that will somehow get them out of all their contracted media commitments. On the other extreme, we say they need a letter from a doctor or something, otherwise we won't believe them. I mean, the latter is clearly too harsh, but I don't think the former is necessarily ideal as well, because you could imagine times when that could be exploited. I personally think sports governing bodies need to kind of codify their procedures around this when dealing with mental health in regards to the media, as well as other things. Otherwise, it feels like media and sports stars and governing bodies are kind of in limbo on this issue a little bit.
Yeah, and I really think that the way that the tennis authorities responded by basically threatening her, you know, fining her, which okay, fair enough, they fine every player that doesn't turn up to press conferences, but then actually threatening to kick her out of the Open, I mean, I thought that was really, really poor, to be honest. When someone has expressed that they're having concerns about their mental health, to respond by threatening them was a really low blow. It's ended up where she felt she has been backed into a corner, and she's had to take some time away from tennis to look after this problem that she has, these health issues, which I think was very courageous of her. And I don't think the tennis authorities have come away from this looking particularly great. And I think it's really important through all this that we do remember why, you know, this has come about. You know, the amount of pressure that some athletes face. You know, she's relatively young, Naomi Osaka. She's got so many endorsements and commitments, you know, outside of tennis. She's really stretched thin, I'm sure, in terms of, you know, different brands trying to pull her in certain directions, the media trying to pull her in certain directions. And then the fact that she's a famous tennis player and she has to invest time in that. Maybe, you know, there really needs to be more effort in terms of helping young athletes with the mental health side of their games or the mental health side of them. So I really think, you know, at the end of the day, I think this is a really positive thing, the fact that she has taken this step. And I hope it does inspire, you know, authorities and sport in general to reconsider the way it sort of treats athletes in these situations.
I also think we shouldn't sort of consider that the authorities and the media are necessarily always entirely at blame for these things. I mean, it strikes me that, yeah, I mean, someone like Osaka is going to have a huge number of commitments, you know, commercially as well as media and, you know, let's face it, her day job, training and playing matches. I mean, I think there's a point at which her management probably need to say, let's not do that commercial deal. Let's hold back on that. Let's not exploit this individual for all they're worth. It's almost like sports stars can become kind of their own brands and their own machines, but they're not machines, they're individuals. So I think that while, yeah, I completely agree, the tennis authorities come out looking very bad in this instance. And there's a huge amount of sympathy that everyone should have for Naomi. I also think there is a wider question about how much the sports industry expects of individual sports stars. And that is a wider question than a particular sports event or a particular individual.
Absolutely. And I very much, as a journalist, accept that the media has a role here as well. I mean, if you look at some of the stories that are circulating about certain footballers, it's absolutely ridiculous. There is a lot of pressure. But yeah, it's definitely a wider issue. And, you know, hats off to Naomi for taking a stand on this. It's really important. And I hope it does inspire positive change. Now, I wanted to move along to Pride Month and pinkwashing. And this is obviously an annual gripe from the industry about sort of misappropriating LGBTQ plus culture and spaces by corporates and other brands. Stephen Strickland, the founder of Talker Taylor Troublemaker, wrote an excellent piece in PR Week about this issue and what it means to be a gay man in PR. I just want to read a part of his op-ed. He said, "There is a small positive in every negative use of our identity for profit, and while not right, hopefully those that make mistakes intentionally or naively, disrespectfully appropriating culture for cash, are weeded out by a collective." And his advice is to sort of live life through empathetic eyes. What is your view on Pride Month and how some brands tend to hijack it inauthentically?
Yeah, well, I mean, it's weird, isn't it? Each year we have these warnings about pinkwashing, as you mentioned, as it's called. And I mean, as we record this, it's only the 2nd of June. I'm not sure we've seen any so far that have struck us as being particularly bad or missing the mark, but it's still early. I mean, I think the principles for activity around pride are like the principles really for any campaign linked to a progressive cause or a purpose. I think you need to ask yourself a few questions. Are you backing up your campaign with concrete action to help the cause and the communities in question? Have you discussed it directly with people affected by it? Do you have members of the communities in question on your team? For what it's worth, my view is brands shouldn't be scared to get involved with activities around Pride Month. I mean, I think we're at a stage where we should be comfortable with commercial organisations getting involved in progressive causes. I don't think that's a problem per se, but they just need to make sure they do it right and they do it with the right intentions.
Yeah, it's a really good point that you raised there. And of course, it's not just Pride where brands are looking for these opportunities to almost sort of, oh, I hate to use the term hijack, but sort of lend themselves towards. I mean, there was that famous case about that statue in New York with the girl and the bull, basically trying to symbolize the gender pay gap and how there needs to be greater equality. But the firm that actually commissioned that had a problem with its own pay gap. So I guess the key here is authenticity, isn't it, really?
Yeah, I mean, it is. I think that a sort of there's a wider point here that I know that when we wrote about sort of the rise of purpose marketing a kind of maybe 2 or 3 years ago, the point that was made quite a few times was it hasn't come out of a vacuum. A lot of kind of purpose and good cause sort of activities from brands come at a time when a lot of governments around the world are cutting back on the amount they invest in causes and in helping people. So it's almost like brands are kind of stepping in to do the right thing in various different communities. And this is a very broad point. It doesn't necessarily relate to Pride specifically. I mean, I'm not sure. I would argue that maybe that isn't quite the case as much at the moment, simply because the huge amount of government involvement in people's lives during the COVID pandemic. But I do think it's an interesting point that still holds to some extent.
Absolutely, absolutely. Right, some positive news to kick off the summer, or what we hope is summer. It's been a few days of sunshine. MNC Saatchi Group appears to be in better shape financially. Now, John, you wrote about this the other day. Can you give us a bit of a rundown? What's going on at MNC?
Yeah, so, I mean, we haven't heard much from the listed groups in the last couple of weeks. We had their results a bit before that. But we had an upbeat assessment from MNC this week. Comes ahead of its sort of full results announcement at the end of the month. It says trading ahead of expectations for the first 4 months of the year. New business described as robust. Secured a £47 million financing deal, which sounds nice. I mean, there's obviously a background to this, the finance, the sort of accounting scandal that sort of started in 2019 and led to quite an upheaval in the sort of senior team and so on last year. It's also us saying that MNC Saatchi spans Marcoms, so it's not just about PR by any means. But it definitely chimes with what I've heard from MNC Saatchi Talk, one of its PR agencies, which formed via merger last year. I mean, that agency had a pretty bad 2020. Revenue fell by a third, but it's gone from famine to feast as the sort of end of last year and the start of this year began. It's been really strong, lots of new business opportunities, and also made several big hires recently. Got a new head of consumer, new head of growth. And this is part of the wider theme we're seeing of agencies building their senior teams for the opportunities ahead. So I think there is, as I say, this isn't just about one agency or one holding company, but I think it's a microcosm of a lot of the things that are going on out there. And on that theme, you know, it's probably worth congratulating the two new MDs at Harvard, George Greenspan and Lorna Hughes. We had a story on their appointment this week, which follows the promotion of Ellie Thompson to CEO recently as well at the tech-focused agency. So again, more agencies building their teams, taking advantage of what will hopefully be an opportunity to claw back some revenue and some profit in the months ahead compared to obviously the extremely difficult time we had in 2020. So let's be positive. The sun's shining. People are being hired. Results are sounding good. Let's be positive.
Fantastic. Well, thanks for joining us this week, John. And our next segment, we're going to take a look at agencies that started during COVID. In the past year, more than 50 PR agencies launched, according to a new study by Wads Inc. And PR Week recently profiled several of these COVID startups. There were some obvious challenges in trying to onboard and manage a workforce virtually, but there were also some upsides in terms of pitching and COVID being hailed as a great leveler. Joining me to discuss this is Richard Tompkins and Felix Henderson. Richard is a co-founder of Where Eagles Dare, and Felix helped launch the Look After Group. Thank you both for joining us.
Yeah, good to be here. Good to be here.
Great to be here, Arvind.
Great. Now, a global pandemic that shuts down large parts of the economy, including a protracted lockdown across the UK, does not sound like the ideal time to launch a new business. Some folks might think you are both crazy. Richard, why did you decide to set up Where Eagles Dare when you did last year?
I think one of the things that you'll probably hear from a lot of those agencies that set up was that we'd always planned to launch. I'd certainly obviously spent a lot of time at certainly previous agencies and had come to the conclusion that doing something for myself with some partners was the way to go. We made that decision towards the back end of 2019. So when we finally kind of pushed the button in at the start of 2020, we hadn't planned for any of this to sort of come about. So really for us, it was something that was a kind of a bit of a nuisance rather than something to react to.
Okay. Having a look at the list of agencies that launched last year, there's quite a lot of triple-barreled names and quite a number of them involved animals. I have to ask you, how did you guys come up with the name Where Eagles Dare?
To be honest with you, the name came from, it's Richard III Shakespeare quote, which also was then the inspiration for a war film, which I'm a fan of. But the name came from that. We were looking for something that sounded good, obviously, but at its heart had something that was sort of inspirational. We're about trying to take brands and businesses up to the next level, and so it felt like a good way to go.
Okay, fantastic. Felix, the Look After Group had a slightly different start to life. Essentially, it was sort of set up as a non-profit to help cash-strapped organisations with PR during the crisis. In fact, I spoke to your business partner, Nick Young, at the time he was looking to set it up, and he was sort of doing it in between jobs. I just want you to sort of take us through that early process and how it sort of evolved from this non-for-profit into a bona fide PR business.
Sure. I mean, in many ways, it's completely the opposite to the way Richard came about. This was unplanned in many senses. This was purely reactive. And this was us viewing COVID as a bit of an opportunity initially to do something good. So Nick and I used to work together about 3-4 years ago at a very different business. And we stayed close ever since. We hadn't worked together after we both left that place. But when Nick was in between jobs, having left one agency for another, and was left in a bit of a difficult situation, he obviously decided it was time to see if he could put his free time and skills to use to help businesses and charities, either putting something towards the COVID effort or just struggling. He put a LinkedIn post out, which got a huge amount of traction in a short period of time. I contacted Nick within the first 24 hours and said, hey, look, if you need some help, I'm on furlough as well, let's get into this. And we built what was effectively a hybrid agency of, at its peak, about 200, 250 people, all working pro bono for a variety of charities and industries such as mental health, domestic violence. We work with the NHS. We work with food and drink businesses in the UK doing their bit to help the coronavirus relief effort. And we ran this hybrid agency doing work for free to put people's skills to use and help businesses through the pandemic. From then, it was Graham Goodkind, who's now the non-exec director of our full service agency, who was obviously the owner of Frank, where Nick used to work, who came to us and said, guys, look, I think there's really a space here for something that focuses purely on ethical and positive social work. I think there could be an opportunity that this pandemic creates for young people to put their creativity to the fore and try and kind of mitigate the experience factor that might have been more prevalent previously. So we just decided, why not do it? And it was the 1st of September last year that we made that full transition from pro bono, initiative into full service agency.
Okay, let's have a bit of an update on where you're at, Felix. How much have you grown the business since then?
I mean, a huge amount. So I mean, initially, when we first started the previous business, it was all about building a hybrid business. So one that it embraced the kind of freelance and consultant model that was going to explode as a result of COVID, and seeing if we could build a hybrid agency. We're still retaining a bit of that, but we are moving now back towards a traditional agency. So at the moment, there are about 7 members of the team working full time in a combination of kind of hybrid and full time capacity. And we work with clients across a really, really broad spectrum. So we work with clients in the food and drink space, a couple of plant-based brands, in the pharmaceutical space, sustainable fashion. And we also work with 2 sort of global businesses. The type of work is incredibly diverse. And the team is looking to grow, at a rate of kind of 2-3 people every couple of months going through this year.
Okay, can you name 1 or 2 of your clients?
Yeah, absolutely. So one of the first campaigns that we did, which kind of put us on the map a little bit, was a plant-based business called Neat Burger, who are a fast food chain in London. They're backed by Lewis Hamilton, and it's very much his way of trying to kind of, take on the plant-based revolution. We also work with a company called Jack and Bri, who are, again, a plant-based business making everything out of jackfruit. We run all of the social accounts for a connected vehicle data business called Wejo, who are the world's leading business in connected vehicle data. They work with about 10.5 million cars in the US every single day. And so we're trying to bring that to life in a way that consumers understand. And we've also just started working with effectively a medical marijuana business based out in Greece called Hellenic Dynamics, who are not so much the product makers themselves, but are supplying the pharmaceutical companies across Europe in the pursuit of hopefully the legalization and active prescription of medical cannabis as a treatment on the NHS.
Richard, can you give us an update on how Where Eagles Dare has grown and some of your clients?
Yeah, absolutely. So we obviously launched in September 2020. Within the first, few months, we were lucky enough to pick up some big clients, with the likes of Bidfood, which is a food wholesale business, which was converting into a consumer proposition, which they'd launched during the pandemic, and we were supporting on how they were delivering that. We've expanded our staff. So we're now similar to Felix. Seven's obviously the magic number at the moment, which are both full and part-time. Again, operating with that kind of flexible kind of working model, some people wanting to do kind of less days than others. And yeah, in terms of kind of revenue, we've been quite fortunate with the clients that we've got on board who have enabled us to kind of post some relatively good numbers, which were kind of above expectations, really. So we're on course to hopefully hit around about 750 by the end of the kind of first year of being in trading, which when we sort of sat down and did our projections, I think we'd have been sort of high-fiving each other if we knew that was going to be the case after the first year.
Okay, can you take us through some of the major challenges that you've encountered launching and running a PR business during COVID?
Yeah, I think the biggest one is obviously the kind of remote working. I think we all sat there, and whilst the world was all locked down, spent a lot more time with our families whilst working. The work-life balance was fantastic, and to some extent we're learning from that, and we're keeping that in how we're kind of growing and evolving. But not being able to spend that time with my fellow founders, as well as our kind of new staff as they were coming in and being onboarded and working on accounts, as well as working with clients, you miss out on those kind of serendipitous conversations, the kind of the bits of inspiration that might hit you sat across a desk. It's far harder to do when you're doing it across a Zoom call or, through a WhatsApp, WhatsApp messaging. So I think for us, that's been one of the biggest challenges. It's had its positives, obviously, being on the other side of being kept at home. Obviously, any startup business looks at the costs that are going to be associated. We haven't had those office costs for a good few months, which is why it's made it, I guess, slightly easier for us. But yeah, certainly that face-to-face interaction with clients and staff has been the biggest challenge for us.
Okay, Felix, have you found that as well? Have you found this sort of lack of face-to-face a major challenge, or what are some of the challenges that you've observed over this time?
I mean, Richard touches on many of the same ones that we faced, and I think so many businesses have faced that as well. I think in addition to that, if I was going to build on that, I think key to any business starting out, I think particularly one where the founders have not been in the industry that long and might have a limited network compared to other businesses, is getting out there and meeting people. And the ability to grow business, the ability to win clients is so dependent on that face-to-face interaction, particularly with a less experienced business. A client is so much more incentivized to take a chance on someone if they can effectively, look them in the whites of the eyes and see what they're made of. And so I think that certainly posed a challenge in the early phases. And then I also think hiring, especially for sort of more junior roles, and especially roles which are going to be really fundamental at the very start of your growth of a business. You're looking for experience, you're looking for expertise, but you're actually hiring a person and a personality. And to try and gauge that over Zoom or think, is this person right for us? Over a kind of virtual networking setup, I don't think it has the same effect. And having said that, we're really lucky. The people that are working with us now are absolutely fantastic, and we appear to kind of got over that. But, there have been challenges. But on the flip side, as I'm sure we'll get onto later, there are also a load of positives and opportunities that come out of a different setup and a different environment.
Let's touch on the opportunities now. Richard obviously mentioned the fact that you don't have to cover rent. So there's obviously some cost savings there, which I can imagine would be very beneficial for a startup. What are some of the other major opportunities that you've found during this COVID period?
So I think we can split these up into kind of more general business opportunities that are not necessarily specific to Look After Group, and also some opportunities that are specific to us and our offering and what we do. For me, it sounds silly, but one of them was time. When you start a business, you have so many little things that need your attention in the early months. And often in the bustle and buzz of growing in the real world, these kind of get kicked down the list very easily. But if your glamorous Thursday night is spent at your kitchen table, running out of Netflix series to watch and nothing to do with that gritty task, you have that focused, dedicated time to just crack on. I also think that time gives you an opportunity to think and to reflect at home, without the distraction of the outside world. You seldom get time to stop in this entrepreneurial environment. So I found that very, very useful. And I think location as well. Our biggest client that I mentioned earlier, Wejo, are based in Manchester. And I would guess that they may well have looked for representation in their local area in a previous environment. Whereas now we've got so used to this remote working setup that they've brought us on board, and we work with them extensively from a completely different city. And I think that might have been less likely to happen before. And then for us specifically, you know, as I said at the start, we focus on, as we call it, purpose-led fame for ethically minded brands. And this COVID pandemic has changed a lot of perspectives out there. The world is different. You know, COVID advanced a lot of that positive social change, and it sharpened our minds to what was truly important and worth fighting for. And both of some of the work Richard does and obviously what we do at We Look After, I think that's helped us become much more of a natural fit in terms of business for this new world, and allow people to say, hang on, I'm going to prioritize a passion about, you know, positive social advancement and creativity and youth and determination on top of what I might have previously prioritized, which would have been experience.
Okay, Richard. Some interesting opportunities there Felix mentions. It's been mentioned to me as well that the sort of use or reliance on video conferencing technology is a bit of a great leveler for small startups. They can compete in a pitching environment, for example, as effectively as more larger, more established agencies. Would you agree with that? And what are some of the opportunities that you've noticed operating during COVID?
I think, to be honest, I would both agree and disagree, which is probably not the the best answer to give. But in terms of, I mean, one thing that Felix touched upon in terms of networking, and as a probably a younger business, or the people within the business being younger, we actually found that we had a lot more time for the networking and caught up with a lot more people, both across the industry and also potential new business opportunities, because people weren't, you know, tied up in lunches and long meetings and traveling all over the place. And so you found that it was far easier to get into the diaries of those kind of CMOs and CEOs diaries than you probably would have done, which has ultimately led on to us having several opportunities to work with businesses where we actually didn't have to pitch, because the relationship was, you know, it was there, but we had to kind of build upon it. We had the opportunity through the pandemic, through video conferencing and sort of phone calls and more time to sort of land those pieces of work. And then I guess to sort of come back to my first point, on the flip side of it, the biggest thing, and as Felix touched upon, is that face-to-face contact and clients seeing the whites of your eyes, even if they've met you before or they know you through another connection. It's so much more powerful, particularly at something like a chemistry stage, to be able to sit in a room and, you know, to sort of feel the energy and to bounce ideas around that maybe aren't part of, you know, a slideshow that's on screen where you've got, you know, four very small sort of postage stamp kind of pictures of the clients that you're talking to, trying to gauge a reaction, or is there something, you know, a takeoff point or something that they could mention, or how do you kind of bring them into that? So there are positives in it, in so much as being able to talk to a lot more people, but I do think the kind of need to get back to face-to-face chemistry meetings and pitching is something we're super, super keen to do.
There's also been quite a bit of talk about using this sort of COVID opportunity to reset business models. Is that something that you believe in? Do you believe in having a startup at this time that you've been able to sort of reset thinking around what an agency business model looks like?
Completely. I think. Look, I've come up probably through one of the most traditional ways, you know, from a kind of work experience a very, very long time ago, all the way up to being an MD and leading a business. And so that puts you in a very kind of traditional mindset. And so the easiest thing to do is to when setting up a business is to look, all right, how do I get to the way that agency was in its second year, third year, fourth year? And that would have felt very, very traditional in terms of structure and the way that we approached it. And actually the pandemic and the way that we were working and have been working with both staff and clients has made us sort of look at it and reset what we should be doing. And it's made us fundamentally change the structure of how we are going to be working. You know, we've signed up to the office definitely not being somewhere where we will be on a Friday. So there will never be a kind of Where Eagles Air Friday office, unless there's something dramatic or a huge pitch that needs to be responded to. That will be a thing that we'll keep. You know, we're signing up to a sort of 3 days working face to face within an office environment, and that's kind of a given, but anything outside of that is by choice. And also we're listening, I think, far more than we probably ever would have done to the staff that we're bringing on board from their experiences over the last 18 months. You know, what are the things that they either had in their past agencies or, you know, they're looking for from a current business, and how we can kind of best meet those needs? Because, you know, that balance between work and home life is, you know, has had a massive, I was going to say shine a light, it's probably a sort of a huge sun that's been kind of blown in our faces, that it is important, and you can still function, you can still deliver award-winning work, even when you're not in the office, this kind of presenteeism thing is really for us a thing of the past. We're not checking people in at certain times and checking them out, and you know, that's them doing a good job. It's, are they delivering on what we expect them to?
Okay. Felix, you mentioned before about your hybrid working model. Can you sort of elaborate on that and how you believe the sort of PR business model, or agency business model, I should say, will evolve in the future?
Yeah, I think I agree with pretty much everything Richard said. I mean, I think you could bring it, you know, beyond this PR industry and say that business models of the future across the board. For us, to build on what Richard said already, the key word in the culture and company we're trying to build is trust. Because, you know, in a hybrid business model, we started at Look After, you know, hybridly at home. We were in full lockdown when it first began, and it was about 4 months until Nick and I even got to spend some time together at the start, which feels slightly astonishing now. But it's about trust. You know, we've just moved into our first office space in Soho in central London, and the purpose of this space is to act as a hub, not to act as somewhere where people have to be, you know, 9 till 5 every single day. It's a place where if you want to come in and collaborate and get involved, come in. If you want to be at home, stay at home. You know, create the best work environment for you. And at the bottom of all of that is a trust that you're going to do everything you can to make incredible work and you know, do your clients proud and do Look After proud and work in the vision of the business we've set up. And if we've got that, and if everyone buys into that, then personally, we don't mind where that work goes on. You know, it can be, a lot of people have embraced this abroad working model. You know, they can work in Portugal for a month, really, for all I care, as long as they're involved, they're part of the team, they're working really, really hard, and the output is stuff that we can be proud of. And I think you'll see most businesses doing that, whether it's big corporates scaling down to half the office space they might have had before and allowing a flexible working model, to startup businesses that may never have an office and will always operate a hybrid model, that we will never go back to the same way it was before. It'll become a matter of personal preference, and the businesses that embrace that, I think, are the businesses that will succeed.
Yeah, it's an interesting point that you raise about how things will change in the future. There was a bit of research by the PRCA that came out this week, which polled senior PR leaders, and only 5% said that they would continue with a 5-day working week. The majority, 95%, opted for some form of hybrid working, whether it was 2 days, 3 days, 4 days, or they weren't really sure. So I guess that is definitely the way that things are heading. Now, I wanted to ask both of you, before we have to wrap up, about your future plans. How is trading currently going, and what sort of optimism do you have for the future of your business? I'll start off with you, Felix.
Yeah, I mean, look, you know, we've been very fortunate. We sort of hit the ground running in many senses. We were lucky to win a couple of big clients at the start that have really propelled us on to continue to win a lot of really exciting new business and new projects. And we've kept growing month on month from September right until now. And our ambition is very, very much for that to continue. You know, I see it in two ways. It sounds quite cliche. Like, in many senses, the reason we've come from initiative to this stage, you know, to a successful a growing business in its early form, is because we've been focused and we've just taken each project each day as it comes, smash what's in front of us, worked as hard as we possibly could to put out work that we're proud of. And we believe that if we do that, we'll get the opportunity to make big, important decisions about our future, because we'll reach that stage. So the ambition is still to grow. The ambition is to grow at a pace. The ambition is to capitalize on our youth, our nimbleness, all the great things that you have of being a startup. And keep growing month on month. And you know, if in a couple of years' time I'm sat talking to you again, Arvind, and we're a business with 30, 35 people, then fantastic. We'll have achieved the growth trajectory and the plan that we've set ourselves and that we'd like to.
Okay. Richard, what is your outlook for where Eagles Dare?
I think we're really, really positive and very, very optimistic about things. I think we, you know, much like Felix, with the kind of the way that the business was set up, our kind of proposition to sort of focus around working with businesses and brands with integrity at their heart, who are looking to sort of not just take from consumers and culture and society, but be able to put something meaningful back in, was a position that we felt very, very strongly about, and has already kind of born a kind of some positive responses from the clients that we've brought on board. You know, the likes of the Innocents of this world, the Bidfoods, the Cazillos, and lots of the kind of startups that we've got who are in a sort of circular economy space. It means that the kind of concept has sort of been proven in some respects. So now for us, the trajectory is to kind of continue to grow. I think we've been, as I say, very, very positive with what's come through the door. Our hopes are that, you know, much like Felix, maybe we should have a competition. We'll do this in a year's time. time and see who's at 30 and who's at 35. But to kind of continue to grow, but grow in the right way and grow by doing the right type of work with the right type of people and hiring the right type of people. You know, we don't want to become a, you know, an agency that's got many, many numbers, but they're at a very, very junior level putting out kind of product placement. We want to be delivering work that's driving kind of actual kind of business change. And that's almost more of our ambition than just the bottom line number.
I'm afraid that's all we have time for today. If you'd like to read more about any of our major stories this week, please visit our website, prweek.com/UK. I'd like to thank our guests, Richard and Felix, for joining us, and my usual sparring partner, John. Also, a big thank you to our producer, Lindsay Riley from Rethink Audio. Thank you for listening, and we hope you can join us next week. Until then, I'm Arvin Hickman. Goodbye.